Welcome to the Starfish Storytellers, the podcast that makes a difference one story at a time by bringing storytelling to life.
I think it was in my early 20s, and I was living with my parents in southern Florida down near Naples. And on the late night TV, I would see Stephen Wright or Emo Phillips, and I just loved those cerebral kind of twists. And I never really gave much thought as to where these people were or where they were from. And I grew up myself in Lexington, Mass. And it wasn't until some years later I moved back up here that I learned that Stephen Wright grew up in Burlington, one town over from me, of all places. So I've kind of admired his humor from afar, but I never really studied, you know, people's backgrounds, or I just plain liked the material. So I've been a bit too much of a hermit in my life, and a lot of comedians are known for being kind of somewhat recluses, and it was, I actually remember the date, it was December 15th, 2008, Stephen Wright was receiving an award. It was some sort of Comedy Hall of Fame, which I guess physically doesn't exist, but he was at Patriot Place at Foxborough, and a lot of the New England comedy legends were there. And it was being hosted by Tony V, but they had other such people as Steve Sweeney and Lenny Clark and Jimmy Tingle. And, I don't even remember the whole, but there were a lot of people that were there. And this was a relatively small venue, like 140 people. And I'm like, you know what? I never get out of the house. I don't stray that far from home. And I just went by myself. And I really enjoyed it. They all took turns performing. And when it concluded, it kind of ties in with my semi-fascination with human behavior, including my own, where it's almost like a bit of an exaggeration, but like a cattle stampede of people leaving. And I don't know if I had known of the term Comic-Con, but I'm like, there were people who would pay just to be here and meet these people. And I'm like, I'm not leaving. There's nobody waiting at home, and I'm not in a rush. So I said hello to Stephen Wright. I think I'd met him once before. And some other comedians. And I went over to Tony V, who had hosted. And I didn't know that it was kind of taboo to go, especially a professional comedian, going like, I've got some jokes to tell you. Or here are some jokes you might want to use. Well, they're in the profession. Jokes are what they do all day long. They probably are not looking for any. And if they didn't write it, and especially if you don't own it and you can't sell it to them, they really don't want to hear it. So he was very polite, and I told him a few jokes. And he said, those are really good jokes. I wish I could remember what they were. I just remember there were three of them. And he said, those are really good jokes. He said, but I haven't heard them. Where did you get them from? I said, I didn't get them from anywhere. I wrote them. He said, you wrote those? And I've never been a person really built on self-esteem. And I'm like, I didn't think that much of it. And he said, I'd like you to call my friend at Giggles down in Saugus on Route 1 and tell him I want you on the open mic show. And I was almost speechless because I would love to do that. It's almost like saying, hey, I would like you to be a rock star, but have no real official training or know what to do on stage. And I contacted them, and I think the thing that was coming up was 2 months away, and everybody was going to be doing 5 minutes, which felt like forever. I don't know, didn't know anything about putting together a comedy set or any of it, and I was just, like I think a lot of people would picture, I was just a nervous wreck for like a month. And I went to an office supply store, and I got these big whiteboards to write on. And I just put together a set, which I estimate was like 19 jokes. And I had a friend designated to sit up front and hold them up, even though and no one else was doing that. And it was what they call a bringer. And I had to have at least four friends. And I've learned a lot of things, like we were using the expression a moment ago, learning things the hard way. Don't tell your friends you're all set and you've got a lot of people because they won't go. So I don't remember the number, but I had a comfortable number of people showing up to be much more than four. And I'm sitting there with three friends and someone telling me you can't go on until you have at least the fourth one. And elderly gentleman I know showed up wearing a cowboy hat, kind of a silly, goofy guy, and he's like, "Hey guys, what's up?" I'm like, "What's up? As you just saved the day." And I didn't do very well on stage. It felt more like a surgery than anything enjoyable. And the next day I got an email from them. They said, you already write on a professional level. We know someone who would like to buy your material. And I guess I went from low self-esteem to having a bit of an ego, and I'm like, I'd rather keep it for myself. And that was really getting my feet wet. I really didn't shop around to do comedy elsewhere. I was thinking, like a lot of employers, they don't want to catch you working for the competition. And when I turn on the TV, I want to hear new jokes. I might enjoy some old ones, but I like to hear something new. So after performing at Giggles, maybe a few times in a year, because they didn't have the open mic very often. And it doesn't exist there anymore. I mean, they have comedy, but no more open mic. And I didn't know it was a very prestigious place. It's difficult to get a spot to perform at. And people are like, "You started at Giggles?" And I'm like, "Why?" And they're like, "It's crazy. No one starts there." So the gentleman who runs the shows is Mike Clark, and he took me aside one day, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, you're here every couple of months or so, and we're hearing all new material, and it's really not polished, and then you come back again, and it's more new material again. And he said, "You don't understand. We basically want you working for the competition so you get better and get out there and get more well-known and polish what you have." And that's what beginning comics usually do, is they go for what they call a tight five. 5 minutes, and you keep working on polishing it. So I didn't know I'd be kind of popular, because a lot of people refer to me as clean and clever. I don't swear on stage. I love to play with words. And I really try not to offend people. And it's mostly been a fun experience, but there's a lot to it.
Welcome to the Starfish Storytellers. I'm the CEO of the Black Dog Group, a Marcom and project management firm headquartered on the east coast of the U.S. in quaint colonial Bedford, Massachusetts. I'm your host and passionate about storytelling. I'm actually on a mission to raise up the next generation of storytellers. We've named ourselves Starfish Storytellers after the starfish story. The moral of the starfish story is based on the power of one. No matter how big the challenge, each action we take makes a difference and has an impact. One step, one starfish, or one story at a time. Every episode, we welcome a new storyteller who will share their story meant to inspire and connect with you. Then we'll break it down and offer tips for any listeners who are ready to tell their own stories. So thanks for tuning in. Now let's get started. Today's episode is about delivering humorous stories through stand-up comedy, and with me today is my friend Scott McNeil. He's a stand-up comedian and self-proclaimed one-liner. He started his comedy career in his 40s, and he's performed with such comedians as Emo Phillips and Kevin Farley, and has opened for a number of other well-known comedians like Gilbert Gottfried, Lenny Clark, Tony V, Kenny Rogerson, and Frank Santarelli, among others. He's won or placed in several comedy contests across New England and has even starred in an online commercial. We'd met when I was the publisher of the Billerica Green News magazine, and we featured you and your extensive fan collection of the classic band The Doors, but I've been following your comedy career on social media for some time. So it's great to see you again and catch up.
Likewise. So exciting and fun to be here.
Thanks for being here. So your story did tell us a lot about your beginnings, but I didn't know if you wanted to add anything for our listeners about introducing yourself.
Oh, absolutely. There's always more to add to a story.
Nice.
One of the things that I've learned is what they call editing. And that can mean all sorts of things in different businesses, but ideally a comic will go to an open mic night or kind of a more of an informal place and video themselves. Because when someone's on stage, even if they've been doing it for a while, they might have habits they're not aware of, looking the wrong way or doing something with their hands and distracting people. But also, too, it's listening for the audience reaction, because that's really what it comes down to. And one of the many rules of thumbs they have in comedy is even if you love a joke that you wrote, if it's not hitting it with the audience, it's out. And even if you've been telling a joke for 15 years and you're tired of it, if the audience still loves it, it stays in. And another part of it, too, is they say, of course, you want to close with your best joke. And they say to open with your second best. But sometimes someone was pointing out to me that not only to end with my best, but I could take some of my better jokes and have like a rapid fire three or four of them at the end, so it goes, you know, better, you know, good, better, best, fantastic, and then it leaves that impression that you want.
And then you're off.
Right.
I really appreciated your story of how you got started. I'm familiar with giggles, and, you know, I think that's wonderful that you got to get a start there. You know, we've talked about storytellers and comedians, you know, comparing. Comedians are the funniest storytellers of all, and but, you know, like you're going to talk about today and like you've already shared so far, becoming a great stand-up comic is not easy. There's a lot that goes into it. You know, I've read that, you know, comedians have to become like the masters of wordplay, and they have to have razor-sharp wit, and they have to have expert timing, and sets have to be relatable because you want to get the biggest laughs out of people. Speaking to this sort of, you know, what does a comedian need to be able to be successful? What other things can you think of that are needed?
Well, one of the ingredients that I was not aware of is that, like I was saying, you take a 5-minute set and start to polish it.
Mm-hmm.
How you tell it, where to pause. And sometimes, too, there'll like be one key word that you withhold, which will be the punchline that might give it like a 180 type of spin. But there's also some acting in it, too, where the illusion of spontaneity.
Can you talk about that? Because, you know, when we had a phone call, you brought that up. And I thought that was a really interesting concept. And I don't know if people really know that that's what goes on.
It's almost like giving away a magic trick, I think, in a way. But it's kind of pretending that while you're on stage, you tell a joke maybe and then snap your finger. Oh, it reminds me of this other thing. But not remind you of anything. This is the next joke you were going to tell anyways, and you've been telling it for 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people, one person I'd kind of like to meet that I haven't is Jeff Foxworthy. And I think he's great at just pretending he's just coming up with everything off the cuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really followed Robin Williams, but I would think he would be one of the few exemptions that he probably was off the cuff, where his mind was just racing and he probably couldn't even talk fast enough to say all the stuff that was going on in his head. And that's very unusual. Most everything is very carefully rehearsed and practiced, and by the time you see someone who's a professional, especially a brand name person, they've examined the material. They've looked at the joke as to how to edit it. Should it say is or and at this point? Or that type of thing. It's almost like a surgeon putting together a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And facial expressions, trying to, I love to mislead people. I like to take linear thinking that usually goes in this direction and play around with it.
And then, you know, not signal when turning.
Right. Just turn and...
We're like, whoop, whoop.
I had a funny moment. I think it was 2011. I was in North Andover. I don't know if I'd shared it, but I kind of give a version of it. But it's a true story. I used to have an opening joke, and I'm not a brand name comic. So people, you know, when they introduced me, people just clapped. And I put my hand over my heart. I genuinely mean it. But also, too, I told the audience, I said, thank you. I said, every time I do stand up, I'm excited and nervous. And I said, on top of this, I'm excited and nervous, too, because I'm about to become a father for the first time. So they all clapped. And I told them, thank you. Of course, I'm very excited about the baby, but I'm extra nervous because I haven't told my wife yet. And of course, it's fake. You know, myself, I've never married. I have no children.
Yeah.
And usually, a professional show is an opener like myself, 15 minutes, then a feature act for a half hour, and then a headliner for usually at least 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the show ended, and people were leaving, and this lady came over. Let's see, I was probably early 50s, and I think she was a few years older than me. She came over to me with a big smile, and she said, we had a great time. We hadn't been out to comedy before. We really enjoyed it. You were funny, and the other comics were funny, too. And I wanted to take a moment and say congratulations. And I said, thanks, but for what? And she pointed to the stage. She said, you know, the baby.
Oh.
I'm like, thanks, but there's no baby. And she's like, no, you were the one. I remember you were the one that said you're about to become a father for the first time. And
she didn't get it.
And I said, that's true. I did say it as a comedian entertaining people. And her eyes went wide like a child. And she said, are you telling me you guys just make stuff up?
And she didn't know.
It was like I told her there's no Easter Bunny. Actually, there is an Easter Bunny, but
yeah.
It would be as if I didn't. Told her there wasn't one, and
wow.
She just looked leveled. That
oh, no.
I wasn't about to become a father, and there was no wife at home. That someone said I should have just let it go and say, ask her her name, and say, well, actually, we're expecting a girl, so we'll name her after you. But, you know, that's a hindsight thing that didn't. But I'm friendly now with Stephen Wright. I get to... He lets me come backstage every few years and hang out for 10 or 15 minutes. And I told him that story. And he was almost in tears. I was surprised. He said, I've never, ever heard of anyone thinking anything we said on stage is real. And sometimes it is. But it's a weird game.
Mm-hmm. For sure. For sure. When we were talking about you coming on the show, we were comparing storytellers and comedians, and you said, more of a one-liner.
Right.
And, you know, a one-liner joke is delivered, it's concise, it's meaningful, but, you know, I'd still argue that jokes have a narrative structure, because I've seen your sets, so I've seen your setup, you have this, and then you go into sort of this dialogue sometimes between you and somebody else, and then the punchline, which is literally the humorous ending of your short story. But when you call yourself a one-liner and not much of a storyteller, what does that mean to you? Like, when in comedy, what's the difference?
Well, to me, a storyteller, and I agree with it, they're both kind of different versions of storytelling. But the other type of comedy is, can't think of a real example, but like I say, I'm a comedian does a bit about, I need to go to the supermarket to pick up a half gallon of milk, which... should be a simple thing. Supermarkets nearby, not a very exciting story, but they make it interesting. I couldn't find my keys. I asked my wife. She took my keys to work by accident. And it's like a series of jokes within a story. And I also think it's an easier type of style of comedy to memorize because you are telling a longer story that take little detours of problems and complications that can be funny, whereas each joke I tell is a joke within itself.
It's a standalone.
It's standalone, And the next joke I tell you probably has no connection or relation to the other one I just told you.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I came back from, because I took a break like a lot of people when the pandemic hit, and I was reorganizing my set because I would have it, I try to group like two or three jokes together, like these are relationships, these are jokes about codependency, these are jokes about work, exercise. So my set was just kind of thrown together without organizing it that way. And I got the impression the audience seemed to like it more, like we have no idea what kind of crazy, bizarre thing this guy is going to say next.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, so far I've been kind of...
successful with that.
Yeah, I've been kind of going more in that direction. But it's, for me, I have lots and lots of material. I've been told I'm very prolific, and some other comics struggle to come up with jokes where I almost have too many. I might have a few thousand. And the first time I opened for Gilbert Gottfried, I worked with him twice. And I didn't even have a count on how many jokes. It took me 5 months to memorize that set so I could do 26 minutes. And it was 64 jokes. And 64 jokes that have nothing to do with each other. But for me, it's like memorizing the alphabet. It's like A, B, C, D, F, G. But why are they in that order? I have no idea why A, B, C, D is in that order, but it just is.
Yeah.
And that's how it should stay. So if you asked me to tell my set out of order...
it wasn't going to work.
No. I don't have them just floating in the air there.
They're well rehearsed.
Yeah.
You know, when I think about the storytelling on stage, I remember this one comedian. I couldn't tell you the joke, but he had this whole storyline around this air conditioner. I think we saw him down at like... what's the theater next to the Wang? Is that, that's not the Emerson. That's, I can't remember.
I don't know that area.
Yeah, down in that area. It's like right next door to it.
The Wilbur?
The Wilbur.
Oh, okay.
It was at the Wilbur. He had this whole storyline around this air conditioner, and he looped the whole story back around to the air conditioner. But it, like what you were just saying, it started with like dragging it out, and then his wife, and then his daughter came in the room, and then there was something going on in the household, and da 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 da. And then he left the house, and then but he pointed out to somebody about the air conditioner, and it was like, it was sort of this like satisfying end. Like when he got to the end, you're like, aha, you know, I caught on to that. So like what you were talking about, sort of the how order is really important to sets.
Well, there's another part that might interest you. Is when I'm dating myself, I can't think of the current shows, but like with Letterman and Leno and Jimmy Kimmel or Fallon, the primary thing for getting on those shows is actually not being funny. It's knowing your time. Being funny is secondary.
Oh.
So you have to know, probably without looking at your watch, exactly how much time you've done. And these people have probably done their sets so many times, they pretty much know exactly. Like Tony V, he doesn't need a watch. If you interrupted him on stage, which he wouldn't want, you could say, you know, how long you been up there? And he's like, I've been up here 18 and a half minutes. And if your time is pretty darn close to right on that. So when you're on a TV show like that, there's lots of competition to get that spot. But if you have no idea the difference between 4.5 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 or 7, you're never going to, if you have people falling down on the floor rolling around, you will not be on that show unless you know your time somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a story of Jeff Foxworthy. I don't know why I mention him so much. I do like him, but he was on one of those shows, and one of the jokes got a bigger reaction than he had hoped for, and it ate up more of his time.
Mm.
So while he's talking on stage, his brain is editing out things not to say so that he still falls at exactly 7 minutes or whatever they hired
wow.
him for. And Jay Leno's, there's a story about him. I don't think you mind me throwing him, but Jay Leno... apparently later in years, I don't know what year, but after he was well known, performing in a famous casino in Las Vegas, and I think they hired him for an hour. And he did an hour and 2 minutes, and they were furious with him. And even though he was famous, they took him aside, and they said, "We have everything set up here to make money. The temperature of the room, the humidity, whatever music or sound effects are, you know, they have everything figured out there." And they said, "We estimate," it was something like, I'm kind of making it up, but it was something like, "We make about $50,000 a minute. You went over by 2 minutes, you cost us $100,000. You're lucky we don't take that money from you. Don't do it again."
Wow.
So it's that, I think that's one of those things that people watching comedy would not guess.
Mm-mm.
You wouldn't know that that's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, if you're doing a professional show, whatever time you're giving, don't fall too short, because they're counting on you to do
the full time,
whatever it is, and don't go over.
Wow.
So.
It's really important. I do a public speaking class, and one of the parts of that, I tell people, you know, when you're invited to be a keynote or you're invited to be a speaker, you need to respect your hosts and understand what is the time slot you're given and speak only for that time slot, because you're a guest.
Right.
You know, and it's the same thing. It's like, this is our club. You know, you're here. You know, this is the time you're given. Stick to your time.
And when I started, every once in a while, a friend would want to come along with me. And I just, hypothetically, if it's an 8 o'clock show, I'm like, all right, I want to be there about 7. And then, well, I was thinking, well, we could stop for supper on the way, and we could get there at 10, you know, 5 minutes of 8. And I'm like, no. They want to check me off that I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to know I'm on the property, I didn't get a flat tire, there's no excuses. And I need to rub elbows with them. You know, you're going to watch the show, I'm in the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different.
It's my job, yeah.
And yeah. Like, so, and then they're surprised, well, this is kind of boring. Like, yeah, it's a job, it's not,
yeah.
You know, we have to hang out here even though there's nothing going on, or sometimes the booker is like, you know, they need to focus in on something else.
Yep, it's a job. It's a job like any other job. You know, we were talking about sort of preparing before you get on stage. Now, you're talking about time right now, but, you know, I'm thinking about routine and travel. And, I mean, there's a lot of things that go into being able to, before you even set foot on that stage to perform, that you have to consider. So when we talk about routine, what is your process for developing one? Like, how do you come? I know that we talked about sort of 64 jokes that don't tie in at all. Like, right. how do you come up with those? Are those pretty much just life? And then what other things are you factoring in and planning for? Like you just said just now, I'm going to get there at 7 for an 8 o'clock show because it's my job and I need to be, you know, clocking in, you know, in a sense. So what other things are you, you know, doing for your routines, and then what other things are you factoring in and planning for?
Well, part of it, too, depends on how far away the gig is, because I might not want to drive an hour and a half wearing my show clothes. It might be summer. I might want to wear shorts, and I don't want to wrinkle up my good clothes. And basically, these places don't have a room to change. They just have the regular restroom that everybody's using, and they can't tie it up. So that's one factor. But I think as someone moves along, you want to get up. The more time you can do, the better. So if you're only there to do 10 minutes, if you can do 15, that's even, once in a while, just show up and the booker's like, someone forgot to come. They were supposed to do 5 minutes. Can you do another 5? And if you waited till that moment, unless you can ad lib, which most people cannot, you're out of luck. You blew it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like being prepared well before, months before that show or any show, just to be able to do as much time as possible and do it well. I guess one of the things I'm thinking as you ask the question, like when you see a sign out in front of a place that says open mic night, it's kind of a misnomer because a lot of them are booked way ahead of time. It makes it sound like you walk in that night, hey, I'm John Smith, Jane Smith, where do I sign up? And like, well, the person might not even be there to connect with, but it could be weeks or a couple of months away to get onto that stage. So it's kind of a misnomer that way.
Yeah. Where do your jokes come from?
I think a lot of comics ask me, when do I write? And I'm like, I have a mind that just doesn't shut off. I find as I listen to people, I like to think I'm a good listener. I've been proved wrong sometimes, but it's like my mind is working at listening to you. There's another part of my mind like, how could I misunderstand what she's saying? Because there's a lot of humor. A lot of humor in that. And a lot of times, too, I'll hear something that in my mind, I'm like, this would be a funny punchline, and I'll build the joke backwards and then tell it forwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people try to write forwards and tell them forwards, and they're like, can't do it. And I'm like, I don't know if I can write forwards so well, but, or like a lot of homonyms, words that sound similar. It's like these two topics have nothing to do with them, but it's like an art to try to weave them together into some sort of misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. We also talked about the written word versus the spoken word and how sometimes the written word isn't going to translate very well at a mic.
Right.
You know, when you write, and as a writer, you can tend to write in a very formal fashion where once you're on a mic, and I learned this from being on the Moth stage, it needs to be more conversational. It needs to feel more conversational. So you must maybe write your jokes out or plan them out. But what do you have to do to tweak them to turn them into that finished product so that it's going to work at the mic?
I think I'm kind of lucky because usually when I write them, the first draft is the final draft.
Okay.
I usually don't rewrite them. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'll think, oh, this could be a little twist. I try not to have too big of an ego that I'm like, yeah, I suppose it could be a little better this way or that way. But you're right, it is kind of like a conversation. And I think, too, sometimes when a comic talks to someone in the audience, usually they're looking for a yes or a no, or like if the comic goes too far, it becomes crowd work, and crowd work is usually
what
not.
What is crowd work?
Crowd work is where you start a conversation with somebody in the audience.
Okay.
And it's usually frowned upon because if you're not the headliner, the people in the audience are like, oh, this comic is talking with us. All the comics after them, we can talk with them too.
Oh.
So they feel like it's an open door. And it can really sabotage the following comedians behind you. And also the booker will probably say, don't do that here again. Like they don't allow it, basically it giggles, no crowd work. It, rule of thumb.
So question for you, I'm going to interrupt for a second.
Sure.
So you're talking about crowd work. You're talking about somebody who's talking with the audience. You were talking earlier about watching your time. Is that something that people like factor into their routine and as like, okay, I'm gonna start a conversation with a couple of people in the front row and I'm gonna try, you know, I need to spend 3 minutes doing that before I go on to, like, is that the illusion of spontaneity or is it like actually they're just not good at with their time?
Yeah, I think once someone works at it, you pretty much know how much time it would take. And like, once in a while I get hired for like to do a 20-minute set, but it's also factoring in pauses. Like I was saying, hopefully they all start to laugh, and there's a curve where it goes up, and then as it drops off, we go into the next joke. But sometimes I've had some very stoic audiences who are just silent. And they're appreciating it, but they're not laughing. And I just run through my material, and the next thing I know, I'm at 16 minutes, and I'm out of material because there's no laughter pauses.
Okay. Okay.
And I wish I'd written it down, but I had an audience of like, I think it was like 35 people. It was quite a few years ago. And they just sat there blank, expressionless, with their arms folded. And it felt brutal because, you know, a lot of like, am I not telling them right? Did someone just die before I got here and I didn't know about this tragic news or what's going on? And then when the show ended, I can't remember, like 3 or 5 different people came over and they're like, I had a great time. You were hilarious. And I'm like, what the heck is that? That's so, they're so contained. And it's like each audience is, I've had it where I've done the same material at different clubs and one place they go crazy and the next place is like, ah, you're all right. It's like, it really, it's a combination, I think, of being an art and a science and still being baffling.
Do you think that there's just certain crowds that frequent certain venues? And I asked that question for two experiences that I had. One, I went to a comedy show New Year's Eve, and the audience were pretty much around my age. It seemed like that. It wasn't a bunch of 20-somethings. It was a bunch of people in, you know, 40s and 50s. And the comedians were awesome. There was 3 of them, and they nailed it. And their sets were so relevant to the crowd. Like, the crowd could relate, and the things that they said, they were just awesome. Everybody was dying, and it was out loud, very loud laughter. Then I think about, and it was up in the Phoenician in Haverhill, Mass. Then I think about this place that I went one time. It wasn't for a comedy show, but it was someplace near Salisbury, Hampton, or whatever. It was a smaller venue. It wasn't like the big club that bands go to on Hampton Beach, but it was like some other smaller club.
Maybe the Winner's Circle?
It was something small. It might have been like Salisbury or Amesbury, and it was Survivor. And I went in, we went in, and it was all tables and chairs, like tables. And so they were on a kind of a small stage, which seemed like Survivor on a small stage. Like, is this what we've been reduced to for our age group? And nobody got up and clapped, and nobody was dancing in the aisles. Everybody sat in their chairs. People clapped, but it was a really subdued crowd. And I felt so bad for the performers, because I felt like, I mean, you must be used to working in arenas, like where people are like on their feet and cheering and, you know. So do you think that a venue, like, do you have any prep, like, do they prep you at all, like what to expect with the crowd ever? And or do you think like certain venues are just going to have certain types of crowds coming in?
I think the only thing in that case would be is, if I'm getting booked for a show a couple months ahead, it's going to be this type of crowd.
They'll tell you that.
They'll tell you, it's like, well, these are going to be older people. They're going to be kind of this type of thing. But usually there's not a lot of instruction. It's like, usually I get booked based on who I am or what I've... Nobody's usually said, I want you to tell these jokes and not those jokes.
Okay.
I've done quite a few things that are benefits. But a lot of times I've been selfish. I'm like, I want to perform. I want to get out there. But I'm like, well, someone is going, usually for a benefit, somebody's going through something pretty bad. And I've been learning recently, I'm like, well, who are they? What is their story? What are they going through? And sometimes I'll go over the other comics and I'm like, well, this person's seriously battling cancer. So let's be aware of that. And once in a while, some of those people aren't there because they're too ill to make it, but it's still a benefit for them. But especially if they're present, I want to respect whatever they're going through.
Right, right.
And I might edit it. I don't have anything that really attacks anybody. I don't. People ask me about being heckled, and I'm like, I've only been heckled like once. It was by someone who was very drunk and didn't know what was going on.
How do comedians handle that? When somebody's heckling them?
Well, I've taken some workshops, and they say to kind of mentally have like 3 insults in your back pocket. Mm. And if someone is like deliberately, they're not just like, hey, I love your humor, or some little, like a 1 or 2 word thing, you know, punctuating, I like that joke.
Yeah.
That's, to me, that's not heckling. But when someone's like, if you're riding a bicycle and someone sticks a, puts a stick in your spokes and you go over the handlebars, if it's that kind of interruption, that's heckling.
Yeah.
So what they say to do is to target them. And also, too, if it's a big audience, if they said an insult to you, say it back into the microphone, because the most of the audience didn't hear the insult.
Mm-hmm.
And it would look like a bad person who's just targeting some random person in the audience mm-hmm. and going up. So you repeat and you let the audience know this is what they just said to me, maybe with some expletives in it or whatever, that if that's what they used.
Mm-hmm.
And then give them your response to them, letting mm-hmm. them know this is my territory, this is my time, behave yourself, or this is... And then the next insult, if they continue on, is a more hurtful one. And then the third one is like...
Decimate.
You go for the throat. And I had heard a rumor about George Carlin that I wish I knew what...
Can you imagine ever heckling him? That would be suicide.
Well, there are some stupid people in the world.
Clearly. Yeah.
But you don't want to look bad on stage, and it's best to defer to the management to handle a problem person. So if he did a little interacting with somebody that wouldn't shut up and let him do his show, I'm just going to make this up like bananas. Like that was the key word.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be like, Mister, you're driving me bananas, or whatever his key word was. That was the signal for security to pretend that they had decided to remove the person.
Mm-hmm.
But it was George telling them to get this person the hell out of here.
Get him out.
So I was like, well, that's pretty clever because it doesn't make him look so bad. But
right.
Like, well, what can I do? Management decided they didn't want this person in here.
Yep. Yep. And we're moving on with the show.
Right.
Because all those other people paid to be there, you know, and they came to see you. And so, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very interesting. When you write out your jokes or you rehearse them or you memorize them, do you find that, are you at a stage now where you're delivering the same jokes the same way every time, or is there
very little difference? Yeah, I think it's pretty much
the same.
Pretty much word for word, which is, you know, and I like to think I'm kind of like a word surgeon where this is it, this is the way it should be. I had a joke I did about perpetual care of cemeteries,
mm-hmm.
and that I was against it. And there were some college students in the room, and I said that I was against this perpetual care of cemeteries. And I said, if I'm going to fight this till my last breath, and if they want to cut that grass, they'll have to do it over my dead body.
Mm-hmm.
And... these college students came up to me and they're like, that joke is perfect. They said it's exactly the right length. It's got the right words in it. There's no words you should take out or add in. They said it's just the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny because I would have never guessed that they would love that particular joke.
Yeah, there's value in that for sure. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I just want to thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And just, you know, sharing all the, you know, behind the scenes, literally,
right.
of what it takes to be a comic. And, you know, all the stories that you shared of, like, all the people that you've met and all the experiences that you've had, I think it's going to be great for our listeners. So thank you.
Well, thank you. The time flew by. It was a lot of fun. Great to see you, too.
Thank you. And to our listeners, whether you hear us locally from the BTV studios in Bedford, Massachusetts, or across the globe on such podcast channels as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Amazon Prime, thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next time. Happy storytelling.